wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Jan Hawken speaks with Alex Marquardt, Executive Director of Climate Defense Project. Desiree Helligers presents excerpts from an October 12th Indigenous Peoples Day panel, and Bill Resnick talks with activist and author Max Elbaum. First up, Jan Hawken talking with Alex Marquardt, attorney, co-founder, and executive director of Climate Defense Project, about student-organized campaigns to stop fossil fuel investments at their universities, as well as the place of student divestment campaigns in the larger climate justice movement. Here's Jan Hawken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Welcome to KABU, Alex Marquardt.
Thanks, it's nice to be here.
Well, you're an attorney with the Climate Defense Project, so it's great to have you on the Old Mole today. Tell us about the work of the Climate Defense Project, and then we'll move into some of these student campaigns around the country around divestment.
Yeah, Climate Defense Project is a small nonprofit that I and two law school classmates started when we graduated from law school in 2016. We wanted to do something about climate change, but we were a little disillusioned with the usual avenues for addressing it. And we shared a sense that to the extent that things were happening, it was coming largely from grassroots protest movements. And so we use a kind of movement-centered approach. We try to promote important legal arguments to kind of amplify the message of activist campaigns. And we've done work on the climate necessity defense as well as fossil fuel divestment.
So how important are university investments in fossil fuels and the overall picture of fossil fuel supports in this country? Is it hard to get a hold of that? Is it a small amount or a big amount? I know there's also the moral authority of universities and the prestige they hold, especially some of these fairly elite schools that have been targeted by the campaigns. How big a part of the fossil fuel support is with these university investments?
I think the figures that I've heard are that many of the schools that have campaigns that we've been working with have somewhere in the order of 2 to 5% of their endowments still in fossil fuels by the time they announce commitments or by the time we start working with these campaigns. That figure is very hard to come by, so it's hard to put too much weight on that. You know, of course, some of these schools have very large endowments, so even 2% is a lot of money. But, you know, nonetheless, we're still talking about probably the symbolic argument or the kind of moral authority, like you're saying, being the primary focus of these campaigns.
So how have the campaigns shifted either in their scope or their strategies since you began, you and other law students organized this campaign, what, 7 years ago at Harvard?
Yeah. So the fossil fuel divestment movement has been going on for over a decade now at universities, and it's become a really popular cause. I think at this point, a lot of people agree that higher education institutions probably shouldn't be allowed to invest in an industry that is kind of ruining our future more than any other one industry. So there's a lot of work that people have done. And I think if there is a progression, it's been mostly along the lines of a progression that's common in many protest movements and probably necessary, where you start by kind of meeting with school officials and showing support for your cause kind of within the community. And then you're mostly met with just resistance, right, or apathy. And so you get progressively more confrontational and more focused on the public narrative as well. I think the campaign at Harvard really did use every strategy known to humankind to pressure Harvard. And I think what they found is that using kind of the media effectively to increase public scrutiny was a really key piece of it. In other words, it's not just enough to organize on campus or show how much support there is on campus. You also need to kind of shout from the rooftops that Harvard is a laggard and what Harvard is doing is immoral and it's probably illegal too. So there's that progression.
And is that amplified by universities, elite universities coming under scrutiny for how they privilege the children of donors or these so-called legacy admissions?
I think to the extent that people are focusing on improper connections or ties in the fossil fuel divestment context, it's been to point out potential conflicts of interest in, you know, people sitting on boards of overseers or boards of trustees at these institutions who also have some connection to the oil and gas industry, for instance. That's actually fairly common just in terms of people's professional histories. And one thing that the campaign did at Harvard was to try to, in fact, they did succeed in electing kind of pro-divestment candidates to the board of overseers there.
In the film Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, there's a section where law students address some of the inequities, the race and class differences in the consequences of confronting the criminal justice system and engaging in civil disobedience. Would you see that picture any different? Would you look at that any differently today, particularly in that a lot of frontline indigenous communities are very involved in civil disobedience and direct actions? What's your assessment of that some years later?
I think, unfortunately, there are still very different calculations for people from different groups wanting to engage in protests and put themselves in places of relatively high risk for getting arrested or interacting with the police. That's the case on campus, and it's certainly the case in these sort of anti-pipeline battles being waged in places like Minnesota. So I think the concerns that were expressed in the film about some people needing to think more carefully about what it means to get arrested and, you know, be at the mercy of the legal system continues to be a concern.
Can you say any more about the scope and the strategy of these divestment campaigns, how the legal strategies particularly may have shifted over time?
There hasn't been much of a legal strategy at most schools. So at Harvard, I and my two co-founders were behind, along with some other students, we were behind a lawsuit there back in 2014, which wasn't successful. But then later on, when we were working at Climate Defense Project, we hit upon this different strategy to essentially make the same argument, but ask the attorney general to get involved instead of us bringing a lawsuit in court. And that strategy has kind of taken off. A lot of schools have contacted us to, you know, file these complaints with their attorney general. And it's been an interesting, you know, argument to make. It's essentially saying that because these schools are nonprofit charitable institutions, they actually are legally required to invest their money in ways that support their educational missions, you know, their charitable missions. And in this case, we're talking about educational institutions. And they're also required to invest in ways that are financially prudent. And so even though the law that we're citing in these complaints has been on the books for some time, it hasn't really been used in any kind of a serious way. And so we're kind of just pointing that out and saying, you know, we think people should take this seriously because the language of it is quite clear.
Would this strategy take activists any further in public universities versus private ones?
The question is whether the universities are organized as public charitable institutions. So even a school like Harvard, which we think of as a private school, is technically, from a legal status, a public charity and has to comply with these legal obligations.
So the same arguments could prevail in public colleges and universities, state schools?
Yes. Yes. And I think there at state schools, some of the arguments are even stronger because you're talking about certain obligations to taxpayers and the residents of the state as well.
Well, before we close, can you say a little more about the work of the Climate Defense Project and what it means to you to be a movement lawyer? I mean, that could be a whole biography in and of itself, but can you say a little bit about the important work you do there that it many ways departs from what attorneys generally do, especially when they graduate from elite law schools?
Yeah, I think being a movement lawyer for me has been sort of a necessary decision. I'm not sure that I could have been happy with myself, you know, going and working at a law firm or doing something more traditional. Not to say that there's anything inherently bad about that. I just think for me, I needed something that was more social justice focused and our work has tried to, you know, just sort of point towards the things that we think are important but underutilized in the legal space, some of these more kind of off the beaten path arguments. And it's been really nice for us to be able to work with activists and work with young people. One of the great things about our fossil fuel divestment work is that it was our first real foray into activism, I think, for the three of us, getting involved in the divestment campaign at Harvard. And so now working with students at these schools who are in their own campaigns has kind of brought us full circle. And that's really nice.
Yeah. Worthy, wise mentors to these younger students, for sure. Well, thanks so much, Alex McCard, for being with us today, attorney, co-founder, and executive director of the Climate Defense Project. And we hope to continue to hear further about your work and keep it up.
All right. Thank you, Jen.
Aim to live a life of sustainability. Instead of burning Earth's resources while polluting the seas, they're ripping out the seeds that grow naturally inside our Earth, leaves the land scarred and wasted for centuries with no accountability at all.
Mankind's greed
will never be pleased.
Will never be pleased.
Watch them building pipelines across the sea.
Across the sea.
Now tell me, let us stand up for the future. Looking back over thousands and thousands of years, we must set the stage proper. Fossil fuels, you fools, wake up and think ahead, young dread. Protecting the future from this injustice. Honor this earth as if our life depends.
Groundation on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the track titled Fossil Fuels followed Jan Hocken talking with attorney Alex Marquardt. Up next, Desiree Helligers presents us with excerpts from an October 12th Indigenous Peoples Day panel featuring Sam Robinson, vice chair of the Chinook Indian Tribe, and Lana Jack, Salilo Wyom activist. The panel was moderated by Robin White. Here's Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The following are excerpts from an Indigenous Peoples Day panel at Washington State University, Vancouver, on the Chinook and Salila Wyam struggles for federal recognition. The federal recognition process is a relatively recent development that began in 1978 during the Carter administration. The process came on the heels of a decades-long policy known as termination that began in the 1940s. In the termination era, the federal government effectively refused to engage with the tribes as sovereign entities and disavowed federal responsibilities outlined in the treaties. It was yet one more attempt to force Indigenous people to disavow connections to their tribes and to their ancestral lands. The panel features Sam Robinson, vice chairman of the Chinook Indian Nation, and Salila Wyam activist Lana Jack. The panel was facilitated by Cheyenne Lakota activist Robin White, who is also a member of the Old Mole Collective. The first voice you'll hear is Robin's.
When we're talking about federal recognition, we're talking about a relationship between the United States government and the governments that were existing here before there was a United States government.
I currently serve as the elected vice chairman of the Chinook Indian Nation. Our territory starts about Oak Point, just a little bit west of Kalama, and goes all the way to the mouth, both sides of the river, all the way down the mouth of Columbia River, into the Willapaw Bay, and down to Tillamook Head. I've been on tribal council for 22 years, and I would just like to say when I first came on the tribal council, we were a federally recognized tribe. And since then, I've spent the last 21 years fighting for that status to get to become federally recognized again because the Bush administration pulled it out from underneath us. We are a sovereign nation. We're sovereign because of our ancestors and the land they lived on, and we firmly believe that. You know, we just need to make the federal government step up to the plate, you know, honor the treaty. The federal government has treated us as the Indians all along. We've had fishing rights. You know, I remember going fishing with my father when I was young in the 70s and having the gamey come up to him and asking for his license, and he'd pull out that blue card, and the gamey would be standing 10 feet away, see that card come out, and he'd say, "Have a good day. I hope you catch a lot of fish." He wouldn't even look at it. He knew what it was. So we had fishing rights. So all along, we've been recognized as Indians, but today we aren't. One thing I like to tell people, we don't have the right to protect the bones of those ancestors that our ancestors would not give everything away for. And that really hurts hard. You know, we have people that have suffered from boarding schools and self-medicated, and we don't have the health care to take care of that. We have all the problems of tribes that are on reservations in our community with suicides and drug and alcohol, but we don't have any way to take care of them. We have no reservation. Our people are suffering, you know, and today we're really putting a push on getting this recognition taken care of. We're telling the senators it's time to stop allowing the suffering to happen. Put a bill forward. We put a bill in their hand in January, and it's gone through legislative review. And we're hoping that it'll pop out the other side and somebody will pick it up and let's get this taken care of finally.
Salila Wyam activist Lana Jack.
Our great fish chief, Tommy Thompson, between 30 and 48, the negotiations for the building of the Bonneville Dam, which was the first dam erected on the Columbia River. They set the parameters with Bonneville being the first, and I don't know if it's Cooley or whatever it is, the furthest dam up. Those two dams went in setting the parameters for simultaneously putting up dams just one after another on the Columbia River, and the Dalles Dam flooded Salila Falls. There's nothing more traumatic to the generations that have suffered this trauma than to lose Salila Falls. Salila Falls is not dead and gone. Been taken prisoner of war March 10, 1957. And because she's been taken prisoner of war, we as the people, her people, have been put on the extermination list and to date apprehended for extermination. On March 10, 1957, my mother's travailed, wailing in the wind as the falls was flooded. Chief Tommy Thompson laid on the tracks in protest. He said, "I will never sign my fish away. I will never signature my fish away. Our lives was nothing." in exchange for mass electricity, when yet our people live down here in extreme poverty. No doctors, no housing, no electricity, no running water. I love my river people. We never left. The people who are on the river are the people who come from the people who never left. Slilo Falls became a lottery, parceled away left and right. Telephone companies, electric companies, railroads, highways, U.S. forestry. They created these departments just to compartmentalize us out and exterminate us. The fulfillment of the promise was meant to be a long time ago. We're sitting here and we're getting low in numbers. Us, the Chinook tribe, the Duwamish, the Palouse. When does our truth matter? We're still under this ongoing genocide. It didn't end. It's not ended. Starving people out, denying them their right to subsistence, fish, hunt, and gather. We deserve justice. We deserve federal recognition because Salila Falls was flooded. We deserve the fulfillment of the promises now. This nation needs to honor our treaties, and the 1855 treaty is the treaty, the only treaty that Chief Tommy Thompson would in one way honor, because the ratified treaties of 1859 and 1865 were specifically written just for these crazy bands of Indians on the Columbia River who wouldn't leave and become a reservation Indian. After the flooding of the falls, alcohol was the only way we could medicate ourselves because we were being starved out. So I honor everybody who seeks justice out there in Indian country for their people. And I pray we could collaborate all together as and form a union somehow, all of us together, seeking justice for our people and for our land.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Anne. Understand that under that policy of the United States government, that assimilation, they wanted to erase Indians. They wanted to erase the history. They would have to admit that these were unceded lands. 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was a thing called termination, where the United States government again tried to eliminate the tribes so that there was no such thing as Indians anymore. And they actually did that, and they took people and they dropped them thousands of miles away into a city and a family. And of course, you're not Indian anymore. Of course, you're not white, but here you are.
But you're not Native American either.
Yeah, exactly. You're nothing now. So, yeah, you're not Indian, but you're not white. That termination was slowed down and stopped. However, a lot of those tribes that lost their recognition or their relationship with the federal government still haven't gotten those back. And that is extraordinarily troubling, that all of a sudden you can just be eliminated or by a stroke of a pen, you know, you're no longer an Indian, you're no longer a human being. Even though we were supposed to be citizens, it wasn't until the 80s that we were allowed to practice our religion. As Sam Robinson said, you know, we weren't allowed off of the reservations.
My heart goes out to you, Lana. You know, I know my ancestors traveled up into your territory in the springs to go to the markets and trade. And so we have a deep, deep history with you as well up in the upper river. I think one of the big things for Chinook is to have a true seat at the table with all the other tribes in the state of Washington. You know, I mean, we have a lot of agencies that listen to us, but, you know, there's certain ones that won't. You know, for instance, the Corps of Engineers refuses to talk to us, and they do a lot of work in our ancestral territories, and sometimes they interrupt our villages. But luckily, we have friends like Kalitz and Grand Ron who will give us the heads up when something's happening in our territory. We need that power in our territory for everything. One day, the Governor Greg Wall, was in their office, and we were holding up that money, that federal money for that park. And a friend of mine was in the office with her, and she told me, she said, the governor said, well, those Chinook aren't recognized. We're going to move on without it. And several people in that room said, I wouldn't do that if I were you. Being recognized would give us that. It would give us a chance to create a healing house, you know, so we can take care of our people, you know.
Yes.
And just a few months ago, we found out that they're going to close the Nacelle Youth Camp. Well, we strongly believe that the governor needs to surplus that to Chinook. It would give us 26 acres with several buildings, that we'd have an instant administration. We could do field schools for people that want to learn about nature. We could have a healing house, because there's at least five people that work there that are in that business that we could keep
they wouldn't be displaced. They can come work for us. And when I say work for us, I mean us and the entire community. Like I said, Chinook's always been good in the community, and we want to take care of those folks around us. Pacific County is one of the poorest counties in the state of Washington. And if Chinook recognition would bring a lot to those people, a lot of resources. The other thing that I always tell people is that it's good to have a federally recognized tribe in your back pocket when it comes to taking care of Mother Earth, because we have a lot of clout. And today we just recently started working with Columbia Land Trust, you know, because they feel it's important that Chinook be at the table with them. But it's all about educating people, educating our own people, creating a reservation so we can bring people back. Because our people are scattered because there's not enough jobs in Pacific County. So if we can create jobs and bring people back, it would be great. For me personally, I would love to see us put in several plank houses and create a cultural center where people can come and learn about how it is to be Chinook and be in our canoes. And I would like to share that culture. You know, we're rich in culture because we refuse to leave the bones of our ancestors. And we feel really good about that.
I'm believing that this is the hour of acknowledgement, and the hour of acknowledgement means our truths matter. Starving out of Indian people because they don't have the right to fish, hunt, and gather because that was our way of life is in need of being put out on the table for everybody to begin to digest and heal. The people who have stolen our land need to think in this hour about reparations and what that means for the people who are under extermination, like us, the Chinook, the Duwamish, the Plus, the Stiliquam, to be allowed to bring our people back to good health and have housing, running water, and electricity. We need our own sovereign nation here on the Columbia River, and we have been put under the scope for extermination, and this must end. It just must end.
What do you think the general public and the citizens of the United States can do to be doing the right thing for these tribes and for recognition?
Right now, I think, the help that we need, obviously, is to get word to the senators, tell them they need to step up to the plate and take care of us. You know, we've been getting lip service for over 20 years from them. I can remember going to fundraisers for Camp Well, and she said, yeah, we need to take care of Chinook, and that was 20 years ago. Spread the story amongst your friends. You know, I'll be giving out some postcards that have our Twitter and our Facebook. We have a lot of social media, and you'll be able to look and go see some of our history, you know, and visit our ChinookNation.org.
I think I just need an attorney. We need an attorney. I think there's enough proof out there that we've been treated both arbitrary and capricious. I could use help all the way around with these documents and research and the writing and the documentation and just making this happen, because there's so much there in these documents that it's just unreal.
You go home to your church, you go to your organization, anything that you're part of on any club or organization, one of the Chinook websites, there's form letters there that you can print out, you can sign, you can use the wording from to make your own. But get your organizations to write to your U.S. congressmen and senators and say, look, let's start honoring the treaties. Let's start talking about honoring the Chinook, the Duwamish, the Salina YM, and the Palouse, all these other tribes that aren't, and there's more tribes than just those. We'd appreciate that kind of alliance and that kind of help, but it's incredibly important to do. If you're a union member, go to your union, your church, your fraternal organization.
You've been listening to audio from an October 12th panel on the Chinook and Salila YM struggle for federal recognition. The panel featured Sam Robinson and Lana Jack and was moderated by Robin White. We'll post the link to the complete panel, sponsored by Native Programs and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice at Washington State University, Vancouver, when we post the show. This has been Desiree Hellegers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
They call it a pipeline, but those on the front lines know that black snake was sent for us to grow, to shed the skin our ancestors pray of wounds old and calloused, so that we may stay, so that we may unite, unity our tool. No weapons are found in this court of rule. Men becoming ki'ai, steadfast in their guard, protecting women's hearts as their song become roots. Roots to cast out healing for all sentient beings. To honor sacred mother, heart forward we heal. The salmon will run, the mauna will breathe, the rivers will flow. The rainbow is here, and prophecy tells us all generations will hear.
Nations and our people that been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock, and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my tribal people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my native people, to all the original people, to all my indigenous people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up. 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 Stand up.
From the beginning we was winning this game on planet Earth. It's been spinning, we've been living and dying, but giving birth, the first of many nations, celebrating them days when all that got made came after what
got me.
These days we cater to these internet memes, internet streams, it seems them streams aren't clean. We need the whole story seen. We're hassling before water has gasoline in it. Malcolm X moment, Martin Luther King with a dream and war boning. Wounded knee plus Alcatraz, doggone it. This is for the rock, with prayers we stand on it.
Oh yeah, we playing on it, the earth we camp on it. In a sweat lodge singing our songs with grandfathers. Heat rocks all in the spot, we splash on them. With a beatbox from my boy, we jam on it. Said a prayer for the black snake killers. Train on the front lines, they are the realest. Stand for your people, stand for your family. Stand with Standing Rock, stand for humanity.
Hey. It takes a group of people who actually care about, you know, Mother Earth and life and water being sacred and the land being sacred, to say we stand up.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my tribal people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my native people, to all the original people, to all my indigenous people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Mini Wachoni, water is life.
Mini Wachoni,
water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
I stand
with Standing Rock.
I stand with Standing Rock.
I stand with Standing Rock.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
I stand with Standing Rock. Stand up.
To all my native people,
woke up the giant, we won't go quiet.
To all my tribal people,
don't mistake our peace as we stand defiant.
To all my native people,
it's the calm before the storm and I can hear it coming.
To all my tribal people,
I'm ready for the battle when we ain't running.
Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up. Stand up, stand up, stand up.
History is on a sad repeat. Is it liberty or we just acting free? As our land depletes from these hands of greed. See, fate is found, how we face the hounds. Take a vow for these sacred grounds. Make a sound that'll shake us out. Say aloud, what can save us now?
What can save us now?
Stand and Rock, alternately known as Stand Up for Standing Rock, that was Taboo, following Desiree Helliger's for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, Bill Resnick speaks with Max Elbaum about the social, economic, and environmental groups who worked in the 2020 election to elect progressives, Biden, and enough Democrats to control the Congress. Max and Bill discuss the importance of working to win elections and how electoral work and movement building can complement one another. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Hi, Max Elbaum. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. Pleasure to talk to you today.
Max Elbaum has been active in peace, anti-racist, and radical movements since the 1960s. He's an editor of the website Convergence and the author of the book Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turn to Lenin, Mao, and Che. And that's now in its third edition. He recently published a book with collaborators Linda Burnham and Maria Poblet. It reflects changes in the world and changes in his thinking. So, Max, tell us about Power Never Concedes and your reasons for writing it.
Power Concedes Nothing, How Grassroots Organizing Wins Elections is a collection of 22 chapters written by organizers who, in the progressive social justice movements, who participated in the 2020 election, sharing their experience, what worked and what didn't. There's five sections of the book. The first section concentrates on particular states and various social justice groups in those states that made a key difference in the election and defeating MAGA and Trump. Georgia is the first chapter. Michigan is the second chapter. There's chapters on Florida, Arizona, written by groups, organizations that integrated electoral work with non-electoral work as part of a long-term power-building strategy. They were clear-eyed that the MAGA movement was an existential threat to everything that they stand for in terms of racial justice, gender justice, workers' power, fighting climate change, war and peace. And their approach was to fight MAGA and build their independent strength along the way. Those kinds of groups and organizations were also featured in the other four sections. The second section is about working communities of color, which played a decisive role in the big turnout to defeat MAGA in 2020. The third section is workers on the doors, talking about the contribution of progressive labor organizations, trade unions, and the national domestic workers in mobilizing the vote against MAGA. The fourth section was about democratic socialism and its role in the 2020 election. And the final section is about national coalitions and organizations that coordinated work across different states. We felt it was important to get those stories out there because the social justice movement played a key role in 2020. In particular, they reached voters that are ignored and neglected by both political parties, by the establishment of both parties. They dig in for year-round work around campaigns and issues that matter. They connect the struggle for political democracy with the day-to-day needs of people's lives around healthcare, around racial justice, around access to reproductive health, and so on. And in 2020, they played a key role in what was a very close election, especially in key battleground states like Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and so on. We wanted to get those stories out there so they could be used. There's a lot of lessons from what worked and what didn't. We wanted to get them out there, so we hustled in 2020. The book came out, was available starting in March this year. Its official publication date was in September. And we wanted to get it out because we felt that those stories were important and contained a lot of lessons for 2022 and 2024. Essentially, in 2020, we fought against the peak of the backlash that's been going on since the 1960s, took off with Reagan, intensified with the Tea Party and birtherism, and has reached its peak, trying to reverse all the gains of the 1960s, and for that matter, the gains of the New Deal in the 1930s. And in 2020, we fought MAGA to a stalemate, and we face that same situation going into 2022 and 2024. So we thought it was important to get the book out so people could read it and grasp whatever they wanted to take from it in terms of its lessons for the next stage.
Yes, it sounds to me that these lessons are really important. We're now approaching, tomorrow is in fact election day. People are apprehensive. Tell us, give us an analysis in terms of 2022 and what should be done in 2024. Give us analysis of what you learned to get that massive turnout from below.
Well, the first thing is the stakes. The MAGA movement, which has taken over the Republican Party, is very explicit about its goals. Wants a one-party state, minority rule, return to the era of a new kind of Jim Crow, push women back into the home, climate change denialism, all wealth to the wealthy, destroy the labor movement. They're very explicit about it. The candidate for governor in Wisconsin said, if I win the election, Republicans will never lose another election in Wisconsin. They already control the Supreme Court and trifectas in terms of legislature and governorships in almost half the states. And they want to use 22 and 2024. In 2022, their hope is to capture the Senate and the House. And they have plans for a legal coup in 2024, no matter who wins the popular vote or the Electoral College vote, between the Supreme Court and control of the electoral apparatus in different states, they think they can install their candidate and seize complete control of the federal government. So the groups in written in power concedes nothing, are clear-eyed about that. And they recognize that to beat MAGA, we need a broad front of everyone who wants to defend democracy or opposed to that agenda. But there's a specific and political role for the progressive social justice movement. It's not going to be done by the mainstream liberal opposition to MAGA. The key things have to do with the constituencies that have a huge stake in social change, but have been neglected by both parties for many decades. Those on the bottom, workers, the poor, peoples of color, those who are marginalized, the LGBT community. Mainstream politics neglects a lot of these people, parachutes in every 2 or 4 years asking for their vote and then gives them nothing. So there's obviously that leads to cynicism about politics and about whether change can be made and whether there's any role at all that people can play. And the kind of groups and profiled in Power Concedes Nothing are dig into those voters. They're there year round. They conduct issue-based campaigns. They've flipped the script on what's called in the mainstream low propensity voters to talk about them as low investment voters. People don't invest in them. So, of course, they don't feel invested in the political arena. These organizations invest in them. They're there year round. They take part in those struggles, whether it's the Unite Here Union, the Labor Council in Houston, Texas, the National Domestic Workers, groups like Lucha, Living United for Change in Arizona, or the New Georgia Project, which are in those communities year in, year round. Lucha was formed out of the, when Arizona was such a centerpiece of anti-immigrant legislation. They worked for 10 years. They got rid of Joe Arpaio, the racist sheriff in Maricopa County. And they flipped moving Arizona out of the hardcore Republican ranks. So those are the kinds of things. There's 22 stories. Not everyone agrees on every detail, but there's those, some of those common themes about how to work and how to build their independent power, even as they participate in a broad coalition against MAGA.
This is KB Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Max Ellenbaum, a longtime leader and activist on the left who co-edited the book Power Concedes Nothing. We just discussed his evolution and that of the left, still building movements from below and also getting much more involved in electoral work. This much increased involvement in electoral work was crucial to defeating Trumpism in 2020. Still, a good deal of the left critiques electoral work, contending that in the final analysis, it is movements from below, majoritarian movements deeply committed and inspired, that can save the world from rapacious capitalism. The critics then contend that electoral work becomes all-consuming and it interferes with movement building. For an example, that if our candidates win, they argue, its backers become complacent. And if we lose the election, the backers, the electoral workers get despondent, or they point out, the critics, that electoral organizing, the Democrats insist on the volunteers using their scripts and answering in door-to-door and phone contacts, exactly the points that the Democratic Party has decided that they think is going to be a winning discussion. And that, then, if people are, in fact, who are really committed, begin to converse in that way, that it they begin to believe some of that stuff, because the fellow phone workers or door-to-door people are also saying it. And the Democratic Party then sort of captures those people who were developing a radical sensibility. Why don't you reply to that, some of those arguments?
Well, it's pretty hard to do politics in a country if you see the ground that most people think is where they participate in the political arena to the enemy class. You have to participate. We don't set the terrain. We have to fight on every battlefront. Obviously, movements from below push social change. But the electoral arena is the place where that gets ratified or not ratified. And you have to be able to influence the electoral arena. You also need a strategy to get political power. And you can't have a strategy for political power in a country that has an electoral system without engaging in those electoral politics, whether you're in Brazil or whether you're in France or whether in the United States. And I think you can see in the last few years the way that things have changed in the left. From the time of the collapse of the Rainbow Coalition in the late 80s until 2015, we were pretty much a protest movement. And they had to contend and protest and do all kinds of important work, movement against the Iraq War, against the War on Terror, against the tax on immigrant rights, all of that. But in 2015, we saw the difference with MAGA taking over the Republican Party and unleashing the kind of stuff that existed below the surface and has been building since the late 1960s, and Bernie's campaign. And Bernie's campaign energized tons of people and showed what could be accomplished in the electoral arena. It's responsible for the re-legitimization and popularization of democratic socialism. And you can see Bernie's trajectory, which is to set an anti-corporate, anti-capitalist pole within a broad front and to fight within the electoral arena as well as outside of it. Now, Bernie's just done an 8-state blitz because he talks all the time about the danger of Trumpism, the danger of MAGA, and the urgency of political involvement in the electoral arena and synergizing it with grassroots movement. I think it's the day after tomorrow. Chris Smalls is on the head of the Amazon Labor Union talking about the links between what's at stake in the midterms and workers' power and linking it with racial justice and all the other social movements. So you can't ignore the electoral arena. The trick is to figure out how to build your independent political power and expand your base. The kind of groups profiled in Power Concedes Nothing, they don't submerge their own agenda within the Democratic Party. They talk about the importance of defeating MAGA. And when they go out and talk to people and get lists and identify voters, they start an on-ramp where those people, they control, they keep those lists, they keep that outreach, and they set people on an on-ramp to join their organizations. The organizations that have thrown down in the electoral arena against MAGA have grown. They built their political power, they built their credibility, and they're in a better position to influence politics. We saw the way that Bernie influenced the Biden administration going into after 2020. So I think that has changed the dynamic on the left. And the vast majority of the left now feels abstentionism or third partyism is just not a realistic strategy in terms of where the population is at and how you're going to do politics in a country where the electoral system is the main way that the majority of people, including the majority of workers, the majority of people of color, vast majority, do politics. We're not going to get everywhere we want only through electoral work, but to get governing power is a stage in the struggle to get state power and change the political system altogether, as well as the socioeconomic system.
Yeah. In addition, Max Albaum, editor of Convergence, two books that received pointing out that Max was a shining light in the story in writing history of the last 60 years, partly from personal experience, of course. Max, it seems to me that these various reform the movements often decide to do campaigns around specific issues. For example, let's say global warming or medical care or almost any other issue, it's quite possible in those campaigns to point out the radical potentials in all of our institutions, radical potentials to democratize. And for example, in the climate movement, the climate action movement, the left is emerging, a left program is emerging that seeks to set up networks of local, publicly owned, democratically run utilities, confederated for storage and other things, but in fact, operating democratically in their community, sort of a combination of participatory budgeting and community organizing by everybody. Max, tell us about the possibilities of doing organizing in that way so that we're committing people to the potentials of actually participating meaningfully in daily life in their communities.
I think there's a tremendous audience out there, receptivity to radical ideas and exactly the kinds of things you're talking about, Bill. There's the younger generation and people who have been through the last many years and are hungering for social change are very open to radical ideas. And we see that with the popularity of many radical ideas right now. But the other side of politics is you have to be able to implement those ideas. You don't win support if you have good ideas alone. You have to be able to show some results. You have to be able to deliver. You have to build confidence that people, that you are not just a critic or someone with ideas, but you're capable of implementing those ideas. So, you know, there's been an evolution of groups like that. So we have, you know, most of the progressives are concentrated in cities. In a whole bunch of cities, people have won different things. Rent control, have developed alternative models, but you mentioned participatory budgeting. In states where the state legislatures, right, because of gerrymandering and so on, are controlled by the Republicans, the state governments then pass rules that say cities can't do certain things. And a lot of those models that you're talking about, which are urban-based, then get outlawed. So a lot of organizations have decided they have to take part in the fight to determine who's in the state legislature and who controls the state legislature. So big campaigns like in Florida, where they won felony reenfranchisement, which was driven from below by organizations, one of them, which is one of the authors of one of the essays in Power Concedes Nothing. And all those kinds of things, who the terrain is determined so much by who holds federal power. Look at what the Supreme Court has accomplished and was threatening to accomplish in the next few years. Voting rights, the independent state legislature doctrine, labor rights. There's another case about federal regulation, whether you can even, some of the rules that protect polluters and so on are going to get, might get thrown out, protect against polluters. So it's not a question of either or. We need to be able to build movements and attract people to radical ideas, and we need to affect the political arena and show that we can make a difference there and build our independent political strength along the way. That's what the Squad, that's what Bernie, that's what all the different progressive and socialists who've been elected to office are struggling to do. And they've made a difference in many cases, and we need to make more of a difference.
This is Bill Resnick from KBOO Radio. We seek to bring a realistic hope in hard times. Our variety is in the variety of movements from below that we cover, that justify that hope. I've been talking to Max Elbaum, a longtime leader and activist on the left, who co-edited the book Power Concedes Nothing. We just discussed his evolution, that of the left, building movements from below, but getting much more involved in electoral work. Max, tell us how people can get your book and the websites that you've published in, and give us a sense of Convergence.
Convergence is an online publication devoted to fighting for a robust multiracial democracy, an economy that works for all on a sustainable planet. You can find it at convergencemag.com. The book Power Concedes Nothing, How Grassroots Organizing Wins Elections, was published by OR Books. You can find it by just punch into Google, Power Concedes Nothing, How Grassroots Organizing Wins Election, or Power Concedes Nothing Elections. There's a special book on Convergence Mag, convergencemag.com. And, Convergence is the sponsor of the book, but my co-editors, Linda Burnham and Maria Poblet and I, and there's 40 different authors and interviewees in the book. I encourage people to look at their websites, New Georgia Project, Lucha, Unite Here, Gulf Coast Labor Council, National Domestic Workers, Working Families Party, People's Action, Win Justice Coalition, that included Planned Parenthood, SEIU, Color of Change, Black Voters Matter, See the Vote, Democratic Socialists of America. Those were all featured in the book.
Max Elbaum, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
It was inspiring. Thank you.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for November 7th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick, Desiree Helligers, and Jan Hocken, and to their guests Max Elbaum and Alex Marquardt. You can find this episode, alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time, at kbu.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there, or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. ¶¶